We will begin. Good morning. Good morning. So we're going to go into the pages in a minute. What we are doing is, last time we read through all the different materials of the Mishkan. We went through some of the depth, and now we're going to continue more in depth to understand. So just a quick overview of a few of the points that I'll just share with you, and then we'll go inside again to some of the Mefarshim inside. So some of this we might have covered a little bit, but just a quick overview. So there's two handouts at the moment. There'll be more soon, but in the meantime, two. One is the Psukim and one is the Sefer HaChinuch, which we'll do afterwards. But first of all, let's say a little bit more about the building of the Mishkan, because last week we did read the key pasuk, besides obviously all the materials that they have to donate. The key pasuk was Va'asu li mikdash, that you should make for me a sanctuary, V'shachanti b'soicham, and I will dwell amongst you. And we mentioned the big question: what does this really mean? Is this a physical sanctuary and Hashem is going to be there, and how could that be, and what does it mean? So there's many different angles of how you look at it, different perspectives. Please, if there's any questions, don't hesitate to ask. So we're just going to go through a few of them, as we say, a little bit quickly. They're not inside yet. This is just orally. So it's interesting because the different commentaries have, as we say, slightly different perspectives on the purpose and the exact definition, if you want to say, what is a Mishkan, what is a Mikdash. Just to clarify that here, when we're talking quite generally, because the Mishkan was with them in the desert, then it went with them into the land of Israel until they built the first Beis HaMikdash, which was about 400 years that they had the Mishkan, more, 450, that they had the actual Mishkan in the land of Israel. And afterwards, 410 years for the first Beis HaMikdash, 420 years for the second Beis HaMikdash. So the general concepts really apply to all of it, to the Mishkan and to the Beis HaMikdash, because generally speaking, it runs through. And a lot of the vessels are nearly the same. Obviously, the Beis HaMikdash, the structure is much different, and it's a much more permanent structure. The Mishkan is a more temporary structure, obviously, and that's also something that we will see as we look at the different, more than the vessels, the actual structure, that it is a structure which has to be transportable, movable. So it has to be able to be put up and taken down easily, as well as lifted easily, so to speak, so that it can be transported with them in the desert. Some of the vessels, we'll see that soon, some of the kelim, are actually not permitted to be transported on wagons. They have to be actually held on shoulders. And that will also make a difference, and we'll see how that works with the weight and how it's made, so that that's possible. So all the different things. So as we say, just generally, this concept that we're discussing today encompasses all of it, in a sense, the idea, the significance of what this Mishkan and this Mikdash is. Okay, so just very quickly, so we say like this. Yes, sure.
The menorah that was in the Mishkan and the Mikdash, which is different to were they the same in the...
Yeah, they were the same. The same. Ours is a different one. Ours is... after the Hanukkah story, when it became a mitzvah, to light the menorah. So we just made a menorah in accordance with that idea of having an 8-branch menorah. But it's not the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash at all. Yeah, which was 7, and yeah, when we get... No, it's interesting. When we get there, we'll talk about it, yeah. It's a bit confusing. Okay, so just to see very quickly, so we say that Rashi's perspective, he says that the word Mikdash is a house of holiness, which means it's a place where holiness emanates to the whole world. That's, in his eyes, the purpose of the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash, that the holiness actually goes from there and spreads, so to speak, to the whole world. Whereas if you want to look at the Evan Ezra, he says more that it's an idea where it's a structure where actually Hashem's presence rests. Similar, but just slightly, a slight angle. Again, like, as I will just go quickly through these different things, but we'll put it all together after. The Rashbam and Chizkuni, he says that it was interesting. It's a meeting house. And we have that word in the Chumash many times, Oyel Mayed. Oyel Mayed means a place of meeting. What does that mean? It means the place of communication. So either between Hashem and Moshe, the Jewish people, between themselves. So a lot of these things that we are mentioning now are applicable also to our shuls nowadays, right? They also have similar purposes, and our Beis Medrash, places of learning, so similar. But in the Mishkan, we have it specific, very specific. So we say it's specifically a place where Hashem and the people meet. So the physical and the spiritual have a meeting point. The Ora Chaim says that a very interesting thing, that the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash assume holiness as soon as they are built. Even before service is done in them, they already are a holy structure, so to speak. And this is an interesting thing, because the question becomes more afterwards, in a sense, does it retain its holiness? So what is it that makes it holy? Is it the service that's done there? Or is it the actual structure that has some type of holiness? So according to the Ora Chaim, if you follow the instructions and you build it the way Hashem says so, the Mishkan especially, and the Beis HaMikdash, then immediately it assumes a holiness. That's why also we know that there's different opinions what actually happened to the Mishkan. Some people say it was buried, it was never destroyed. It's something which was holy. It's something which keeps its sanctity forever. And definitely the Beis HaMikdash, unfortunately, a lot of it we don't know now, but if we would know where it is, we would have to treat it with tremendous holiness. So it retains its holiness, notwithstanding its ability to use as a service, so to speak. So that's also an important thing. Okay, then just to, as we said last time, the very interesting question that comes up, especially Shlomo, it's in Melachim when Shlomo HaMelech builds the first Beis HaMikdash. Is a very fascinating pasuk, and it says that when, you know, he's finally finished the building, and it was a grand, beautiful, magnificent building, and then he makes there's like this comment that it says, "Hashamayim u'shmei Hashamayim lo yichalkelucha," right? That the heavens and the aretz and every nothing can contain God, and yet we're expecting our small structure to contain God. This is a question, but it's also a statement. Why is it the case? Because Hashem said so. Because Hashem said, I'm going to provide you with this tremendous gift of a focal point, of a place, and I will limit, condense, cover, whatever you want to say, contract myself to actually fit within the limitations of this designated space. We know, however, that although that is true, Hashem is obviously not limited to any space. He's found equally everywhere. However, Hashem reveals himself more in places that he chooses to, or places that we prepare for him. So it has that side to it as well. And this is also an important part, as you can say, it's an interesting thing. It says like that, even though we don't assign any physical, you know, limitations to Hashem, nevertheless, the Torah wants us to be able to relate to everything. And because we are physical limited beings, Hashem provided us with a physical place that he can be revealed, just because that's what will talk to us, so to speak. So that's another important thing. A very beautiful thing that the Medrash tells us. The Medrash says that at Matan Torah, you know, when Hashem, when we started to hear his voice, we were like so overwhelmed, right? And like even our neshama went out of our body because of the amazing revelation of godliness. So there's a pasuk in Tilim that says, we say it on Friday night, Koil Hashem b'koyach, that the voice of Hashem is in strength. And it's in, yeah, right? They sing it sometimes in shul. It's interesting thing, it doesn't say kai chai, according to the power of each individual. It just uses an absolute word, kayach. Very, very interesting, because it means like this. It says an interesting thing. It means that it's not his power, Hashem's power. Rather, what Hashem does is he actually takes into account what we can accept. And that's really also the idea of a Mishkan and a Beis HaMikdash, where he takes into account the fact that we are limited physical beings. We want to have a relationship. We want a certain revelation. So what does he do? For us, he contracts, he hides, he covers himself in order for us, with our ability, our power, to be able to grasp as much as we possibly can. And yes, sure, Sylvia, sure.
What was it?
So it's a very good question, because the truth is Hashem doesn't have a voice, right? But he obviously did enclose himself into some type of a sound. And it was the Aseres HaDibros, it was the Ten Commandments in Lashon Kodesh, in the Holy Tongue. Yes, now were we able to really absorb it? Not really. And that's why Moshe Rabbeinu had to repeat it all. But we heard something.
Yeah.
Yeah, something.
Wasn't it just thunder and lightning?
No, it wasn't just thunder and lightning. Definitely not. No.
But they say cold.
Yes, yes, it was. That's it. It's very hard to understand. The whole experience of Matan Torah is hard for us to understand. Yeah, yeah. Even the Mishkan is hard for us to understand, and the Beis HaMikdash, because we unfortunately don't have that kind of a revelation. But the only thing that we can, a touch understand is, I think, for everybody it's different, a different experience, but for most people, the ones that we share, let's say Yom Kippur by Ne'ilah, if somebody has that high spiritual, inspirational feeling, that would be something that would be permanent when you were in the Beis HaMikdash. So you'd feel, so you could, it's like you almost feel Hashem as a reality, you know, and that's what you would say it. For the shof, there you go. So that's the shof.
I feel this.
That's beautiful. So the shofar is similar to Hashem's voice in a sense. But yeah, that's a beautiful thing, Rona. You see, that's so magnificent. Some people feel it when they go to the kaisel. Different people would have it in different, and some people just feel it different times in their life. So you can, but that's what they had in a permanent way in the Beis HaMikdash and the Mishkan. So that's quite incredible. But yes, okay. So just, I just want to go a few more small things before we go into the Sefer HaChinuch, which he has his own view of what the Mishkan is. Just to see, we went through last time about the Rambam saying that it's weaning them off of the, so to speak, the Egyptian, if you want to say, the limitations of the physical material reality, which they were so almost captured in. And this was part of their growth to get closer to Hashem. He had to give them something of substance, something material. That's the Rambam's view in Meir Nevuchim. Obviously, many people don't agree, but then we have a few others slightly similar and different. So it says a beautiful thing that the Ramban has a very, very beautiful explanation. He says that the Mishkan, it's a very beautiful thing. If you think about from the beginning of creation, so first we had Hashem created Adam, he was in Gan Eden. Now Gan Eden obviously was a permanent state of Mishkan, you know, that was, Hashem was revealed there, absolute. But then he sinned and he was kicked out of Gan Eden. When it came time when the Avos were born, Avraham, Yitzchak and Yaakov, because they had such a special neshama and they had such a special mission, they were able to start revealing Hashem in this world again. And they reached quite a high level of revelation in the sense where they had a very deep connection with Hashem in a very real way. They conversed with Hashem, so to speak. But what happened was when we went into Egypt, we lost that. Egypt obviously was a place of darkness. The slavery was physical slavery and spiritual slavery. So now the Ramban says, when they left Egypt and they received the Torah at Har Sinai, Hashem wanted to restore the Jewish people back to the level of the Avos. That's what he explains the Mishkan is. So the Mishkan is the experience of the Jewish people almost being again like themselves, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, being able to feel Hashem in such a real way. And that's what the Mishkan says. It's a very, very beautiful idea. I just want to see the Abar Ben Nel. He says it's a very symbolic act. What's the symbolism? A very interesting thing. And this is something a little bit different, because until now we're almost saying that it's like you have to go to that place to feel that godliness, even though we know we can all build a Mishkan within our own hearts. But still, the place has a certain significance. According to the Abarvanel, it's a very symbolic thing. And what's the symbolism? That the mistake that many people make, and it's easy to make, is that the spiritual reality is somewhere else. So Hashem does create the world. He's in charge. He's in control. But he's above us, a little bit beyond us, so to speak. And there's this separation. The idea of the Mishkan is to bring Hashem into our conscious reality, moment by moment, in every part of us, of ourselves, to really internalize Hashgacha Pratis, divine providence on every detail of our life. Which is an interesting one, because you would almost think it doesn't do that, because it's a special place that you have to go to. But the idea is that if you go to the Mishkan and you feel spiritually inspired, you take that home with you. And then you realize that just as Hashem can be in the gold and the silver and the copper of the Mishkan, he's in the gold, silver, and copper of my home, of my life. And that's what the Abba Arbanel's view. And obviously that view helps us nowadays a lot more because we don't actually have a physical Mishkan, but we learn about the Mishkan. Learning is similar to it being a reality. And this idea, we see that when we, you know, come to a shir and you learn, soon we'll get there when we learn about the different vessels. And the idea is that it's not that the Arein just remains in the book, you know, there's a nice picture and it's there in the Chumash. The Arein is part of you. It's part of your life. And that's the idea. And we are meant to, and that's the goal, is to take this as our reality and that Hashem is really part of our daily life. So that's a very big one. I just want to read you something. I didn't make a copy. This is a translation of the Kuzari, famous Kuzari, very interesting philosophical work. I just want to show you how he says. So he says, what's the function of the Mikdash? So he says, nature, as we know it, is composed of various elements which combine together to produce the world before us. As natural as the world seems to us, only Hashem knows the quantity and quality of elements needed to create it. So he says like this, only Hashem knows why one combination of elements creates vines and another living beings. So he says, so too with the Mikdash. Hashem commanded certain dimensions and specific materials for the construction of the Mikdash. These, coupled with the Israelites' donation of the necessary materials, combined to breed a new spiritual force which led Hashem to dwell among the Jewish people. So it's really something that we explain generally about mitzvahs all the time. Many people have a question. They say, what do you think Hashem really cares about a detail like, you know, if you light candles at 7 o'clock or 10 past 7, what's the big deal? Or 7 or 7:30, who cares, right? All these little details. You have enough wine in the cup, you don't have enough wine in the cup. What's the big spiel? So we always explain that it is a big deal because Hashem knows the formula, so to speak, by which if you combine this and this and this and you do this, this, this and this, it's going to bring to such and such. Now, obviously, the hard thing for us is to make the leap that the physical details is what's going to bring about a spiritual result. That's a little bit hard for us many times to realize. But I'll tell you what's interesting. I think that what we can, if we would think about it, so to speak, with the right perspective, we would see something interesting. That even Hashem has given us a gift in life that he's made it easier for us to understand why. Because nowadays we know it even more. You know, if you ever go, like sometimes you go to a doctor, you say you're not in such a good mood. I'm not talking about clinically depressed, just a little bit low. Sometimes what they'll say to you is exercise, right? Exercise, walk. And now they've proven it, that it actually does, it lifts the, whatever, it lifts the, exercise. What does exercise have to do with mood? So you think mood is an emotional state of being, exercise is a physical movement of the body. How could shaking a body, so to speak, change your mood? But it does, it's a fact. So if the physical affects the emotional, why shouldn't the physical and the emotional affect the spiritual? It's all the same. It's, in other words, it's we make that barrier. We decide that there is some wall that separates between the two and that they don't meet. But it's not that way. And Hashem, in his kindness, has given us the formula. And that's what we need to follow. So that's the beauty of the specific measurements of the Mishkan. And it's important to keep in mind, because when we will go, it's very technical. Like, does it really, 1.5 by 1.5, you know, and this material, not that material. So we see that, yeah, it does make a difference. And as you know, too much exercise, no good. Too little, no good. The right amount, everything works properly, you know, as if you do it properly. So that's how it works. That's as the Kuzari seems to explain it in that way. I just want to see. Yes, I just want to see if there was any more important. There was a very beautiful one I just want to show you. This is an interesting one. This is from Reb Simcha Zissel of Kelm, so one of the Sifrei Musar. So he gives also an interesting one about the function of the Mishkan. And he says that the idea of holiness being concentrated and confined to a set place, he says it's like the idea of smell. Because we said, if we're saying Hashem is confined to one place, how can that help us to understand that Hashem is with us wherever we are, right? That's the idea of the Mishkan. So he says it's like the sense of smell. With the sense of smell, so it goes we know, through our nostrils, right? That's the entry place of the body. But the entire body has pleasure from that sense of smell. So there's one entry point, but it spreads throughout all of us to the point, which is interesting, with smell, a person can actually start to feel either good or nauseous. And where is the nauseousness? Not in the nose. It's in the whole, in the stomach and everywhere else, right? So he says the same thing. So the Mishkan's like the entry point where the spirituality enters, but then it spreads out everywhere. So it's actually very beautiful. And it shows us also, and he says also, the interesting thing he says also is a little bit like electricity, where now we know that really, even if something looks dark or looks dull or whatever it is, there is a potential of a spark there. You just have to find it, so to speak. And that's also the idea of the Mishkan, to know that godliness is everywhere, but you just have to ignite it and find it, so to speak. So all of these different beautiful aspects show us different insights of what the Mishkan is. Now, on the other sheets that were there, you see these. I feel that I have to do this inside. It's just the way he writes is so beautiful. This is the Sefer HaChinuch. We've done him in the past. And the Sefer HaChinuch first gives a whole introduction. He's so poetic and so magnificent. And he lets us into his, I don't know how you say it, but his way of thinking and his approach to Torah and just to generally to his whole Yiddishkeit. And he also lets us into, it is very beautiful, almost his psychological, if you want to say, need to explain things. So I just want to show you something, because he says something very powerful, and this really, he says it applies to the Mishkan, it applies to the whole Torah. But I'll show you, so let's start on Tzadik Hei. Do you see, so there's a little one over there, yes. And it says like this. So I'll read you some in the Hebrew, then we'll do some in the English. Livnois bayis l'Hashem, l'shem Hashem. So this is first just explaining the mitzvah itself. What is the mitzvah? The mitzvah is to build a house for the sake of Hashem. Kloimar, and he defines it, sh'niya makrivim sham karbonaisenu elav, that we should be able to bring our sacrifices to him. So this, as we said, this is really the view of the Rambam, Maimonides, who the point of the Mishkan is to bring sacrifices. And then he says, v'sham tia ha'aliyah l'regel, right? And that's where we will go up, you know, three times a year. V'kibbutz kol Yisrael, the entire Jewish nation will gather. B'chol shana, every year. Shenemar, how do we know this mitzvah? V'asur li mikdash, as our pasuk said, you should make for me a sanctuary. V'zayis ha'mitzvah kailelas ima ha'kelim, this mitzvah includes in it all of the vessels. Hatzrichim bebayis, that are needed in the house. El ha'avayda, for the service. K'goin ha'menayra, v'ha'sholchan ha'mizbeyach, v'chol shar ha'kelim kulam, and all of the other vessels. Okay, that's just the mitzvah. What's the root? What's the meaning? What's the significance? So if you look, misharshe, that's how he always says, misharshe, so what's the root of the mitzvah? Ma shetire b'soif dvarei, you will get to it at the end of my words, because he has to first give an introduction. So what's his introduction? So he says, v'ochein miyirasi l'hiskarev el mishkan Hashem. Even though I am afraid of coming close to the sanctuary of Hashem. What does that mean, he's afraid? Ki yodati. What?
Who is
he? Sefer HaChinuch. It's not known. It's a very interesting thing. It's not so known who the author is. There's different opinions. One thing we do know, and we'll discover here, is a Levi. When did he live? He lived in about the 1100s, I think, 1200s in Spain. Yeah. Yeah, very, very beautiful. He goes through every mitzvah, as we know, and it's a bit confusing exactly who the author. Yes, so let's see, he says like this. V'achen, some people say he wrote for his daughter, some people say that's other people, different opinions. Okay, but he was a Levi, and we'll see here, he hints to that. Okay, v'achen miyirasi, so I'm afraid, he says, but never, why is he afraid? What does he mean he's afraid? Ki yadati kol hakarev hakarev, because I know that anybody who comes close, im loy his kadesh lemada, if he hasn't purified himself, made himself holy enough, so to speak, sufficiently, lo yire habayis v'chai, will not see the house and live. Now, this is very interesting. He's talking not about entering a Beis HaMikdash, right? That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about entering it in the mind, understanding the significance, the root of the mitzvah. So already we see something, that now when we sit here and we learned about the Beis HaMikdash and the Mishkan, the approach that the Sefer HaChinuch has, and really it should be our approach, is that this is not just some abstract concept about a building that existed thousands of years ago. As we are learning, we are entering the Beis HaMikdash. That's what he is saying. And he feels a trepidation. He feels afraid. He actually, it's as if to him, even though it's only an intellectual kind of idea, to him it's mamish that he's physically approaching the Beis HaMikdash. And he has a bit of a doubt. Maybe I shouldn't. I'm not pure enough. I'm not holy enough. Who am I? But let's see. Let's see how he continues his... He lets us in, as we say, to his own dilemma, if you want to say, what's going through his own struggle. So he says like this, Gam ha-kayhanim ha-nigoshim la-avoyda yiskacharait the kayhanim. We know when they would come close to doing their service, they would obviously become holy. Bevayim el ha-kaydash lefanai, when they approached the holies. V'ha-leviim achai, you see, the Leviim, my brothers, that's how we know he was a Levi. Later on, some people, it says there was other versions that have changed that words, but in the original ones, this is the writing. So anyways, he's a Levi. What did they do? He taharu, they purified themselves. Ayonof, Aaron, Isam, and Tnufa. Aaron had to wave them. You know, there was a whole preparation before they were allowed to come and serve. Terem, Yitnu, Kailam, before they can sing, because that's one of the big things that the Leviim did. Beheichal Hashem. And he says, Amarti gamani, agid atzosi, ve'ereich, hisnatzlusi, neged skenai, ve'erchatz b'nikoyen kapay, terem ele beis Hashem. A very, very beautiful thing. He says, I'm going to speak my thoughts, and I apologize. I apologize. I start with an apology. Before my elders, I'm going to wash my hands, he says, in innocence, as the Tillim says. And I'm going to try and purify myself before I start to go up to the house of Hashem. And he says, Yadua hadavar mefursum beineinu ha'am mekablei ha-mitzvahs. It's known amongst the nation and all of those who accept upon themselves the mitzvahs. Ki shivim ponim la-Torah, right? There are many ways to explain. 70 ways, it says, but there's really many. There's so many ways to explain the Torah, and they're all correct. That's a very important thing that for people to know, that every, as we, you know, we give all the different mefarshim, but they're all correct, right? They're all holy, they're all correct. He says, "V'chol achas men sharashim gedolim v'rabim," and each one of the 70 have many different roots, if you want to say, and many different branches, and all different ways. In other words, he says, "V'chol shayrish v'shayrish anafim," each one has different branches. So there's thousands upon thousands of ways of explaining every aspect in Torah. Kol echad yisa eshkol gadol, he writes very poetically, and each one of the branches, in other words, each explanation has like a bunch of grapes, if you want to say, so each one has fruits of its own. In other words, it's infinite. Torah is infinite, and the understanding of it is absolutely infinite. Nechmodim lahaskelibes, and he says it's so beautiful. They're like these delicious grapes that are, like, if you want to say, they give pleasure to those people who understand the depth, right? Who have, so to speak, whose hearts are wise. Yoim yoim yoitziu perach l'shoikdim aleyem. And it's not a one-off. It's not like you get to go into this vineyard once and pick a grape. Every day, anybody who's persistent and who learns, every time they open up and they learn, they have the opportunity to have pleasure from another grape, so to speak. If you will be, how do you say it, if you put the effort in, if you'll be consistent and you keep on learning, you'll keep on having more and more, deeper and deeper pleasure in your learning. So he says, and he says, beautiful, right, these flowers of wisdom and good intelligence. Kol einayim mi'irais v'rachava v'nosva oimek chachmasa. And he says a very beautiful thing. It's like such magnificent words. He says, it's like such a depth of knowledge, and it widens the person, it opens the person, it deepens the person. Let's see how he says it. Ach ein kayach ha'adam lahasig tachlisa. Nobody can ever reach the end. There's no end. It just keeps on going, deeper and deeper. As we say, k'may shehayid ha'melech ha'chocham, as Shlomo ha'melech himself says, amarti, how do you say this? Ech k'may, I can't even see. V'hi rechayka mimeni, right? So he said that even though I try to understand, but it's far from me. I can never reach it, never grasp it fully. So as the Sefer HaChinuch says, it does give you tremendous pleasure, but it's always a little bit elusive because there's always more. And the more you learn, the deeper you see it is. So this is also, this is part of the beauty of it. In a sense, it could be a little bit frustrating, but the idea is how deep and how amazing it is and how much there is to learn. V'im kol zeh, ein laharpas yadai ha'isek ba, ki im ma'at, v'im harbe mimena yoichal kula misuka. Very, again, very, very beautiful. And he says, even though, you know, even with all of this, the person, even though, and like we say, it could be a bit overwhelming, and he says, it's impossible, I'll never get to, even Shlomo HaMelech didn't understand it properly, so why should I even try? So that's why he says, no, that's not the way to look at it. Every single person should not be lazy and should not hold themselves back. So he says, whether you eat a little bit or you eat a lot, everybody according to their ability, that's fine. Even if you're only going to eat a little bit, you will still enjoy the sweetness of it. You will still have the pleasure. And this is the incredible thing. So he says, I know soon we're going to get back to the Mishkan, but I just want to show you how he says. And he says, "V'im kol zeh ein, okay, sorry. V'im yesh kam asher mipri eitz hagan lo yisosig yodam lakachas, yikhu lohem aleihu l'trufa." It's very beautiful. He says, and for some people, maybe they won't even be able to get to the fruits. Just take some of the leaves as a healing for them. So even, and this is a very beautiful thing that sometimes we do feel, especially when you come somewhere and some, I don't know, people have been learning many more years, or people have a higher intelligence, or whatever it may be, or have the language, whatever it may be, and you feel a lot less than. Sefer HaChinuch says, no. This is for everybody. And anybody who engages in whatever part of Torah they're able to will benefit from the sweetness of it, whether it be the fruits or the leaves or whatever it is. It will give them so much, so we all have to keep on trying. And we all have to keep on engaging, even though it's way beyond all of us, as we say. And then he continues and he says, me, who knows the great like depth, if you want to say, and the great width and the length, in other words, how much there is. As he says, very beautiful language over here. It's like the wonders of it is way too high for me. It's like way above me. I can't hold myself back. I don't know what that word. I think it's like, he's like, chutzpidik, I'm still going to speak about it. I will rely on what my teachers taught me. Ligrais inish, ve'afal gav de la yoda maika amar, shenemar gorsa nafshi litav. And he brings a beautiful pasuk. It's a pasuk in Tehillim that it says that, so a person should just keep on trying, keep on learning, even if he doesn't know what he's saying. As Tehillim says, my soul pounds on it with longing. Now, what he's saying here, and he says it in many places, is that even though, really, I know myself, and I really shouldn't even be touching this, as he said at the beginning, because it's petrifying, and I'm not holy enough, and I'm not smart enough, and I don't know enough, but he can't hold himself back. Because of the pleasure, it's like, I guess, what the picture, I mean, for every person it's in a different way, but it's like a delicious fruit or whatever, and it's sitting there in front of you. If it sits there for days, you just can't hold yourself back. It's just too tempting. The sweetness and the longing of it, it's just too tempting. And therefore, the dangers notwithstanding, or the depth notwithstanding, or the beyond, doesn't matter, he has to engage. So now he's going to try to explain a little bit about this topic. As we see, this is one of the deep ones, but he's still going to explain. So he says, what is the idea of the Mishkan? So I'll just show you, now we'll read quickly in English to get an idea. So I do want to do one more beautiful thing today. So he says, if you see where it says, "Know my son," that's like the third paragraph, that all that is attained in regard to the eternal, when people observe all his mitzvahs, is only this. So he says, what's the idea of mitzvahs? It is the desire of Hashem to do us good. And as a man becomes capable and ready by observing those precepts to receive the good, then Hashem grants him beneficence. In other words, we know, Teva Hatayv Lahitav, Hashem is good and he wants to give good. How do we become worthy of the good which Hashem is itching to bestow upon us? By doing his mitzvahs. That's what he says. He says, you do this mitzvah, then I will be able to bestow the good upon you. You become a vessel for the good. So he says, he therefore made them know the good way, so that they may be good. this being the way of the Torah. For by it a man becomes good. Consequently, anyone who fulfills his precepts fulfills his desire. And what's Hashem's desire? By being worthy then to receive his beneficence. Because his desire is to give us good. So we make ourselves good, so we become worthy that Hashem should be able to give his goodness to us. So that's the desire that we fulfill by doing the mitzvahs. On the other hand, if any person does not prepare himself for this, his evil is great, for he knows wherein the desire of the eternal Lord lies, yet he carries out his deeds in opposition to his desire. Okay, so that's general mitzvahs. I just want to see, let's go to the next page. Let's go to page where it says number 3. I just want to read 2 more paragraphs to see, let's see how this applies to the Mishkan. That's generally to mitzvahs. Okay, let's see something here. This you can take and you can read, as he says. Okay, I want to go now to, let's see now. See where it says, now with this settled clearly in our mind in regard to the precepts. Okay, oh, sorry, I'll just tell you orally, he says, explains that really all mitzvahs are there to make us good. And the truth is that mitzvahs also brings reward. They do. And Hashem tells us, you do this mitzvah, you get this reward. You do this, you get this punishment. And for some people, that's what motivates them. But then there are very great people who they're not necessarily motivated by any reward. They're motivated just because they want to do what Hashem wants. It's similar, as we know, in a small way, to somebody you love. You want to make them happy. It's not because of what they're going to do for you. You just want to please them. And this is like the level of the avos. They did it because they just wanted to please Hashem. It had nothing to do with any kind of reward. He says, now with this settled clearly in our minds in regard to the precepts, it compels us to say that building a Beis HaMikdash for the Eternal Lord, there to offer up our prayers and our sacrifices to Him, would be entirely in order to prepare our hearts for His worship, not because He needs to dwell in a house of human beings and to come under the shelter of their roof, even if it should be built of the cedars of Lebanon or of cypress woods, for heaven and the heavens of heavens cannot contain Him. Right, that's the pasuk that we said, it's in Melachim, as by His Spirit they endure. All the more certainly would His glory have no need of a house built by human beings, perish the thought. So obviously Hashem doesn't need the house. What's the idea? So he says, this is surely a known and clear matter, that it was all meant, and here's the key, for making our physical selves worthy. For the physical self becomes qualified through his actions. As good actions are multiplied, and as they are continued with great perseverance, the thoughts of the heart become purified, cleansed, and refined. So the more we actually physically do, the more, this is the Sefer HaChinuch's theory generally, that it's not about first paying attention to our beliefs and our feelings. First, we do, just do, whether we feel it or not, and our feelings will be drawn after our actions. So that's why there's so much detail in the building of the Beis HaMikdash, and afterwards, in the keeping, you know, the upkeep and all the sacrifices and all the laws, because it's these laws that give us that focus, and then our hearts and our minds will be drawn after it. And then what will happen? We will be focusing on the presence of Hashem. So it's not for Hashem, as we can see, it's all for us. He doesn't need the house. Okay, just one more paragraph. Now Hashem desires good, as we said, for human beings, as we have stated. Therefore, He commanded us to establish a site that should be pure and clean to the ultimate degree of cleanness, and there to purify the thoughts of people and to rectify and perfect their hearts towards Him. And that's what happens when we go to the Beis HaMikdash. We feel that even now. We feel that when we go to the Kaisel, you feel, you sort of, as you approach and the closer you come, there's that uplifted feeling and that cleansed, almost kind of, it's like a purified feeling. And this is the idea, and this is what it does. And then hopefully you take that home with you. That's the idea. So as he says, and a very beautiful thing also, he says he chose a site, so talking about Yerushalayim, and prepared it for the good of human beings, perhaps because it is the directional center of the world, and the center was chosen in preference to the extremities. Or for a reason that he knows, we might not know. But the point is, and I just want to read you 2 more lines, it's a little bit further down in the next paragraph, I just want to show you. So it's interesting, he compares it to just like he said, sends us prophets, which guides us. So too we say, in his great kindness to set a place for them in the land of Israel that should be prepared for the good of people and for their merit, all this out of his loving kindness for his humans. The point is, in any case, though, in truth, blessing and holiness would increase there according to the good actions that people would do there. It's very interesting, because we said the Beis HaMikdash has a holiness notwithstanding. It does. But the more good we do there, the more we increase the holiness, and the more we will feel the holiness. So it also gives us that, if you want to say, that push and that encouragement to actually be able to engage, as we say. And then he says, beautifully, let's see, and with the good actions, the wellsprings of good would open in response. For indeed, the holiness of the place in its state of ruin is not to be compared to its holiness in its inhabited condition. So now, unfortunately, we don't have it in its completion. But in Mirtz Hashem, when it will be rebuilt soon, we will have it in that way. But even now, it still retains a tremendous holiness. And that's something that's a mamish, a gift that Hashem has given us. So now, I just want to... There's one more beautiful thing before we will continue on with the actual Caleb. Yeah, here. There's one for you and one for Sylvia. And so now one of the, this is a very important one also as a basis. No, the very beautiful idea here in this sikh, I hope we will, yeah, Emirat Hashem will be able to cover this today. Very, very beautiful concept here. And yeah. Okay. No, I think that, yeah, I have Baruch Hashem, it's good. So on the top you have a kliyakar. So I'll just do this quickly, because then I want to go into this. The kliyakar gives a general instruction. Now this kliyakar, truthfully, is taken from later on in the parasha, but it doesn't matter, it'll apply to here. One of the materials that were used in the Mishkan is the Atzei Shittim, the famous Atzei Shittim, however you translate it. Shittim wood, acacia, cedar, different places translated in different ways. Acacia wood, but really it's shittim wood because we're not really 100% sure. It's a type of wood that they used for many of the things, especially the boards, the wooden boards. We'll see soon, even the arayin was made with this acacia wood, but then it was covered with, you know, plated with gold or whatever it is. Okay, so let's see about this. So he says like this. The Kliyakar tells us, Hakrushim, so those are the boards, and he says, Behei Hayidia. Hainu oisan arozim. So he's talking about here. It's interesting that he uses the word arozim, and erez is really a different tree. Erez is the cedar tree, but anyways, this was the tree shenata lehem Yaakov b'Mitzrayim, and this Rashi brought that Yaakov planted in Egypt. What happened? Simin, and let's see in a minute, we'll see more about it. But here he says a very beautiful sign. L'davar hakrushim l'mishkan. He says, when you look at the word hakrushim l'mishkan, it's the same gematria. I did not figure out this gematria, but he says, of Yaakov Avinu nota lahem arozim b'mitzrayim. Okay, I don't know, it sounds like a lot more words, but Yaakov planted for them these cedar woods in Egypt. Because what is the gematria? And this is an important thing. He says that the number of both of them make, if you see tough, tough, resh, tzadikei, which is 1,095, because 400, 400, 295. And the word for that number is tisratzeh. Tisratzeh from the word like ratzon, but it really means appeasement, that they were wanted again. Because what's the whole idea of the Mishkan? As we said, one of the big things was that it came, that they built it after they did the sin of the golden calf. And the idea was that Hashem should now rest amongst them again, showing that he was appeased and that he loves them again, right? So there's peace again. There's a relationship again. So that's why he says this is the number, Ki Amar Yaakov LaKadosh Baruch Hu, because Yaakov obviously already had a prophecy before, and he saw what we would do, and he wanted to, as we say, prepare the cure before the illness, right? As we say in Torah. And what's the thing? So he asked Hashem, Bametis Ratzel Maisa Hegel, what, how will the Jewish people, so to speak, make up and be able to do tshuva after? Could you imagine? Yeah, so many years before. Is that amazing, Leah? So many years before, he had a vision that something's going to go wrong. It doesn't mean that he saw exactly. See, it's very interesting with prophecies. It could be he just had a sense, a terrible sense. Even Avraham, I know, even Avraham knew about the Egyptian exile, which is a lot longer after, right? And he was, yeah, they had this they had these visions, they had this prophet, they were prophets. And these are his children, don't forget. It's not so simple. I'll tell you also why. We won't jump there, but Yaakov had a neshama, we say a neshama klolos, a general neshama. His neshama contained all the neshamas of the Jewish people. So it wasn't even like somebody else doing something. It was something which he felt deeply inside of himself. And he could feel that there was something negative that was going to happen. And he was worried. He was afraid. And that's why, as we say, in the ideal world, nowadays, unfortunately, sometimes Hashem throws us things and we don't know, like now, right, with this virus that they didn't know, so they don't have anything yet prepared. They're trying to work on it. But when you know about something before, you prepare for it. So Yaakov had this, if you want to say this, intuition. So he said, what can be done? So Hashem says, I'll give you a plan. And what's the plan? Something that will help you to remedy the situation. And this is very beautiful. So what is it? So he says, V'heshev le'akadosh baruch hu ba'atzei shittim. A very simple thing, it seems. These atzei shittim, these special shittim wood. V'chein isa b'medrash. So what does the medrash tell us? Atzei shittim l'chaper al shtus ma'isa egel. That these special trees, they were there to atone for the shtus, it's a play on words, shittim and shtus. Shtus is folly, stupidity, all the, you know, when the people acted in such a way that was literally not understandable when they served the golden calf. And then he says, v'nirtza lahem l'kapara l'fnei Hashem, and this will make them beloved again, wanted again by Hashem. Now this is very cryptic words, and we have to understand, what does this really mean? I just want to see something. I'm not going to read any more now. I want to go into the next part. And maybe afterwards we'll see a little bit more of the Kli Yakar. So let's go now to number two. Let's understand a little bit more what's happening. So first we have just a general question, and then we're going to come back to this. It says like this. There's a technical question in the Pesukim when we read it. It says, V'yesh leimer habir bazeh bepashtus. What's the technical question? The technical question we said was, we asked this question the whole time, is why does it say vayikhuli, right? Instead of vayitnu, give. Instead of take, instead of give. Okay, so this was a general question. And we said it's because the Jewish people, so to speak, set aside, and then it was taken from them. So obviously there has to be a lot deeper ramifications of this and what this really signifies. So he says, Hatzivoy al nidvas ha-mishkan, so the command of the donations of the Mishkan, Nermar beloshen vayikhuli truma, that you shall take from me all of these donations, all these offerings. Tikhu es truma, see, as we read, ha truma asher, tikhu meitam, and all of the psukim tell us, taken from them. Filich ayra havalai loimar beloshen nesina, it should have written it with the word nesina, giving. Dahainu pu'ulas ha-minadev, which would be concentrating on the action of the one who is donating, mibnei Yisrael, laseis es truma sashem, to give this donation to Hashem. Umadua ne'emar b'loshon kicha, why does it say it with this language of taking? As we see, it seems almost like the people who are going around to collect, we're more putting it on them, that they're taking. Okay, so I want to show you something. Oh, there's a parenthesis. Okay, it doesn't matter. Okay, let's see v'zehu peirush, she'elas Rashi. So this explains a very big question. Oh, actually, okay, sorry, because we did this so long ago. We are explaining, okay, Rashi tells us something interesting on the Atzei Shittim. He says like this. The question that Rashi asks is, where did they get, remember we said, where did they get this wood in the desert? Remember, so Rashi tells us the whole story, that kind of wood in the desert, where do you get it, right? So the truth is, there are simpler ways to explain it, because they could have just bought it from some merchants on the side, or perhaps, I don't know, maybe they schlep, whatever, who knows. Anyways, but Rashi tells us a whole beautiful medrash, that Yaakov Avinu planted these, not planted, he cut these trees down in Israel, still, and he transported them with him to Mitzrayim. He replanted them in Egypt. The roots. From the roots he took them. Yes, you're right. He uprooted them. Exactly. And he replanted them, that's right. And I guess for 210 years, even more, then a lot of them would have grown. And he commanded the Jewish people that when they leave Egypt, they should take it with them. And that's what they did. And that's how they have these Atzei Shittim in the desert. So where are they from? These are made in Israel, right? These are not made in China. These are made in Israel. This is actually quite incredible, if you think about it, that the Mishkan contained, this is a beautiful, beautiful thought. The Mishkan in the desert, before they enter the land of Israel, already have the holiness of Israel with them, which is absolutely unbelievable. That in itself is special. But besides that, they had these wood trees, so to speak, growing around where they were living in Egypt for the 210 years that they were slaves. And we can understand, the Midrash describes what used to happen. The children would walk around and talk, and, you know, parents talk to children and share stories. And parents would share with their children that this, you know, where this comes from? This is from our grandfather Yaakov. And what Hashem told him to bring it to Egypt. Why, the children would ask? Because we're going to leave Egypt. Well, the children were born in Egypt. To them, there was no other place except for, this was their only reality. So you understand what went on over there. This made, first of all, made Israel real, because they have something they can actually touch that came from there, which is unbelievable. But we'll see, it's much deeper than just that. So this was something which they lived with, and then now they're traveling with it because that's what they were told to do, and they have it with them in the desert. So let's go on to understand how it works in the Psukim, and because it means so much, the significance. So he says, this is what Rashi asks. Umeayin hayu lahem bamidbar. How did they have it? Where did they get it from in the desert? What does that mean? So his question is an interesting one, because Rashi takes a very interesting assumption. He says that if you look at the pasuk, vayikhu li truma, take for me truma. What does take for me mean? As we said, that the Jewish people set aside and then it was taken from them. If you set something aside, that means you have it. It doesn't mean you buy it. It means you have it. Where did they have it from? Even if they could have bought it. But that's not what it says. It's like, go to your tents and set aside wood. Okay, gold and silver, we know they have. Spices, we know. But where do you have wood in your... Because they all had. Everybody took some trees with them somehow, transported it. Imagine these trees went through the Yamsuf. It's incredible to think. But they had these trees, these wood, whatever. It wasn't trees anymore. Now they were cut off. Now they didn't have to replant them because now they're going to use them to build the Mishkan. But nevertheless, these are pieces of planks of whatever it is, of acacia wood, and they had it. How do we know they have it? Because that's the language used. Take from me, which means set aside from what you already have. So you see already why Rashi has to bring this medrash. That's very, very important. So let's continue inside. I just want to show you. Very, very beautiful. So he says, we're on, it's still, I think it's still the same page, right? Okay. Let's see. Okay, we don't have to read this part. I want to see. Okay, let's go to number three, because it's all, look, and go to the next page. Show you inside a little bit more from the next page. Okay, so... oh, you know, I'm so sorry. I'll tell you this part. Oy, it's not going to work. It's so late. Such a shame. Okay, this is such a beautiful lesson, but I can't just... I'll just share one thing. This is not the beautiful lesson. This is technical, but next week. We'll start with it next week. I feel so sad. No, there's such a beautiful one here. Anyways, I thought we would even... He says a very interesting thing. He asks the question about the dyes. You know, it's a different color wool, right? So they also have to take. So what do they bring them... like a palette of dyes with them? How does that work? So Rashi says, that's why Rashi explains all the different wools as if it was already dyed. So it was like that you could have, because we know that in Egypt they had a lot of sheep. They had a tremendous amount of sheep. That was one of the things that kept them separate from the Egyptians. So they would have shorn a lot of the sheep, and in the normal way you do dye different colors, that's a normal thing. So it makes sense for them to have, as Rashi says, semer, which has this color, and you know, this kind of a wool, which has the color of purple or the color of red or the... So that's why it makes sense technically even to say that this was wool of this color, as opposed to saying that they took wool and they took dyes and that's what they donated. It was more wool that was already dyed, so to speak, in that color, and then we'll see what Hashem wants them to do with it all afterwards. And also interesting is that he also mentions sheish. And the shesh was flax, as we know, and it's made from pishtun, made from flax. And it says, because it grew there in Egypt. And we already were told that that grew there in Egypt. And that's why we know that they would have also had that, because that's something that was very, very found. So they also had. So everything that they did, they took from what they had. Is that fast, maybe? Do we have 5 more minutes or no?
Yes.
We do? Okay, so you know, let's go. So let's go to page number 4. I want to show you. Yeah, okay, good. So number 4. Let's see page number 4. So I'll show you. And hey, so he says like this, that still it's not 100% understood. Let me just see something. Oh, yeah.
They actually painted the ships right before they left.
Before they left.
That's part of transformations. It's taken something that was there in Mizraim, died, they used it, and now you're going to take that same thing.
Yeah,
and use it. Good.
Yeah.
And then you took the raw material.
It's quite incredible. You could imagine the luggage was very colorful. Yeah, sheep running around. they had very precious. You know, we think, you know, a lot of times you see the pictures, you think that they left Egypt, these poor, I mean, the poverty, you know, well, they were wealthy Jews. This wasn't, you know, it's not simple.
They had the energy to carry all this through.
Imagine. Imagine, I know. Planks, 100%. So he asks the interesting question. The question that Rebbe asks is, why? It's all very nice and good to say that Hashem said to take it from what you have. Why? Why did they have to take it? Why couldn't they just buy it from the neighbors? What's the big deal? Easier. Travel light. You know, we always say nowadays when they weigh us, forget it. You could, like we used to say, we used to travel and schlep everything. You know, you believe it or not, when you're going to Israel, you're going to America, everything's there. You don't have to schlep it with you. Why do you have to schlep it? There's stores there just like there is here. So why schlep? Why did Hashem make it this way? This is the question.
So those timbers, they weren't used to build the Sukkot in the desert.
Okay, so that's an interesting question. It doesn't sound like it. Maybe after the Mishkan. They had tents.
Wood, and apparently it wasn't used.
It was for the Mishkan. Yes, specials.
Yes,
amazing. Yeah. I don't know what happened after with the leftovers. Could be they were, you know, they could have used that. But yeah. At the beginning, what they were, yes, that's right. All designated for this holy thing. So that's the question. So the question, so the answer, but I'm going to ruin it, but I'll just tell you quickly. He says like this, very, very beautiful. He says, as we just said, the whole point was, Yaakov was told to take it down to Egypt, so that when the Jewish people were in Egypt, and they were suffering, and they were slaves, they would have something physical, substantial, growing in their back gardens that will give them, A, the message of remembering Yaakov, first of all, and B, the hope that they're leaving. Because why would Yaakov have schlepped it down and commanded them to take it with them if it's not going to happen? It's going to happen. It's here. It's a physical reminder that you are actually not here permanently. This is a temporary state of being. And there's going to come a time when this wood is going to be used for something absolutely incredible. The person who says this is Rabbi Tanchuma in the Medrash. What is the word tanchuma? Like nechama, comfort. This was an incredible comfort for the Jewish people throughout their time in Egypt. As we say, it wasn't just words of comfort, it was substantial comfort. And it continues very, very beautifully. He says that, I just want to see, like I said, we're doing it very quickly, but the nechama, as we say, is like a pshat, it's like a physical thing that they actually can touch and feel and schlep with them, you know, and cut it and take it with them. But the bottom line is that they have it there all the time. And he says that this is a lesson for us as well. This is not, as we said, like the Sefer HaChinuch says, this is not just past tense. This is present tense. What does present tense mean? Present tense means that what we have to realize is we also have Atzei Shittim with us. So we might say, my backyard doesn't have an Atzei Shittim. But the Rebbe says a beautiful thing, that the Atzei Shittim that we have are the tzaddikim of every generation. The Pasuk says, Shesulim Beveis Hashem, he says a very beautiful, how does the pasuk go? It actually brings it, even in the Kliyakor, he brings it, but it's from Tillim that we say it on Shabbos. I forget the pasuk. Sorry, it talks about tzaddik hatamar yifrach ke'erez balvanan yiske. Right. The righteous will flourish like a palm tree and grow tall like a cedar in Lebanon. Ke'erez, just like these. So the tzaddikim are compared to Erez, which are these Atzei Shittim. Every generation we have tzaddikim, and these tzaddikim are literally the Atzei Shittim of our generation. We see them, they inspire us, they lift us, and they give us the reality that this is not permanent. Why? Because a tzaddik is actually a very interesting thing. A tzaddik is similar to us, they're human beings, but they have a special neshama where they can feel the reality of the redemption even now. Because to them, Hashem is real. That's what redemption means. So they are like, almost like, if you want to say, they are like those trees that come from Israel. So they are made in Israel. They're what, that's what they are. They are the geula at the moment. And these tzaddikim travel with us throughout history. Hopefully this is like enough, and now we're all going back, so to speak, and being retransplanted, if you want to say. But these tzaddikim are very, very beautiful. As he says, the word nasi, which is a word for the leader of the generation, it stands for Nitzutzoi Shel Yaakov Avinu, has the spark of Yaakov, which Yaakov was the one that inspired them to bring these trees. And we know that the word nasi means to lift, to elevate. So what they do, what these tzaddikim do, is they elevate, they lift, they inspire us to go beyond the difficulties and the darkness that we are experiencing, but to make the redemption a reality. And that's the idea, as we say, and that's what, it's so, so magnificent, and that's why, let me just see how he says it over here, this is our nechama, this is our tanchuma, this is our atzei shittim. So we had to have them with us from Yaakov into Egypt, into the desert, and then back into the land of Israel. And what's very beautiful, it comes full circle, because it comes from Israel and it will go back into Israel. And that's the beauty, that's what we believe, right? As the Jews, that's what we are. It's not the middle of nowhere. We are in the middle of this circle, and we are getting there very, very, very soon.